In this edition of Critical Futures, we are launching a series called Racial Community Healing to explore how the St. Louis region and other cities have developed community-driven solutions to racial injustices. Many of these injustices have been punctuated by the death of community members as a result of police violence. In St. Louis, the death of Michael Brown Jr. 10 years ago has accelerated sweeping changes in how communities here are leading social and economic change with frameworks that promote healing, racial justice, anti-racism, and equity. In today's episode, we talk to Ashley Winters and Darian Wickfall, who are members of the Racial Healing and Justice Fund's Community Governance Board, an initiative of Ford Through Ferguson. We discuss their efforts to heal the core, that is, to create space for communities to express narratives of oppression and grief, to create spaces for community members to find sources of support, to build networks of resilience, and to find and exercise their individual and/or collective power.
All right, welcome to Critical Futures Podcast. We are here talking to members of the Community Governance Board from the Racial Healing and Justice Fund, which is part of several initiatives of Ford Through Ferguson. And we have also our co-host, Rhonda Ballou, who will introduce herself. And then we will turn to members of the Community Governance Board who have joined us today. Rhonda?
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rhonda Ballou. I'm a professor of public health, health equity advocate, researcher, arts advocate. I'm here today, and Keanu and I have been working on evaluating the Racial Healing Justice Fund and really trying to find out from our participants today, you know, what makes the fund tick and what, you know, what's your advice and what are your words of wisdom in terms of keeping this work going and keeping anti-racism work going and improving the status, health status, well-being, social, mental health, community.
Great. Thank you, Rhonda. Ashley?
Hey, everyone. My name is Ashley Winters. I am a reporter, assistant editor for the St. Louis American newspaper. And how I got hip to the Racial Healing Justice Fund is through a good friend of mine who recommended that I join the board. I'm for all things equity and racial healing and making sure that everyone in the St. Louis region not only has a chance to survive, but to thrive in an area that feeds the whole body. So mind, body, spirit, and soul.
Great. Thank you, Ashley and Darian.
Hi, everybody. My name is Darian Wickfall. I am the executive director at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. I'm an arts advocate, media consultant, artist manager, DJ, author, a lot of different things. And I came to the Community Governance Board through a lot of different friends. Some people had recommended me to apply the year before that I actually applied. I've been on for 2 years now, since 2022. And so I didn't apply in 2021, but I just saw the good work that was being done and some of the groups that were being funded. I was actually already working with, like Rustic Roots Sanctuary. So I thought I'd take the next step and try to, you know, apply and be on the board, and I ended up being accepted. And so here we are.
Great. Well, thank you both. And so in your opinions and or your definitions, how do you define what the Racial Healing and Justice Fund is and what its overall purpose was designed to do?
That's a good question. So it makes me think of the first thing. So let's break this down. Racial healing. So healing a group of people that have been systemically oppressed for past decades, right? This goes all the way back to slavery. So undoing all of those atrocities that have affected us mentally, that have affected us emotionally, financially, health-wise, our education, our housing, our job and career choice, unhealing all of those things that we have experienced through the hands of slavery.
Yeah, I think Ashley did a great job, number one. But so I'll kind of talk about the other part, the Justice Fund, right? So we're trying to heal systemic racism by funding people in a justice mentality, right? So not only are we giving out the money, but we are focusing on people that are righting the wrongs, healing the core, as it were, through their work, so that we are having an effect on those, on that systemic racism and the effects of those things that have happened in our history.
That's a great sort of next question in terms of thinking about healing the core, which is one of the fundamental principles of the fund. Can you speak a little bit more about what healing the core means to you all, and maybe a little bit about how you operationalize that as a member of the Community Governance Board?
So, yeah, so healing the core to me really means taking care of people first, because I think a lot of funding bodies tend to fund organizations or nonprofit businesses that have a particular cause, but we're looking at, if we are funding a group, how many people individually will be affected in a positive way. And so I think, to me, that is what healing the core means, is like starting with the person, the individual, and each individual that has helped collectively helps all of us.
I agree. It's, think of it as starting with a circle in the center, and then starting with a circle outside of that a little bit bigger, and then continuing that cycle. So you're healing core and allowing that to spread out into a larger scale of people that we are trying to help. So to Darian's point, if we fund this organization or this group or this person, the work that they are doing can impact that circle, and then these people who are healed can now impact that circle. And so it is creating or undoing everything that that has been done before.
The idea of healing the core, as you both have described it, is both metaphor. There certainly, you've also provided some imagery related to it, but also method and process. With the idea of, if we are supporting individual organizations, no matter what their size is or sort of the breadth of their current or potential impact, the idea is that you're hoping that through this fund, they are able to continue to sort of reach others and be a part of sort of a connected network of healers to some extent. Or those who are, you know, developing programs and services to really sort of have a broader reach into the community. Does that sound pretty fair, pretty reasonable based on your description?
Definitely.
Yeah, I would say so.
All right. Anything else you want to add about sort of what healing the core means for the fund?
Well, I will say that now that you mention it, I think about the holistic approach that we take as this fund, like I think we take a non-European minded approach. We're kind of coming from an African indigenous approach to this. And so when I think about healing the core, we're also trying to heal people's spirit, right? So like, we are trying to fund groups that not only are going to help with logistical things like postnatal care and diapers and taking care of your kids after school and things like that, but there are groups that were using sewing to help veterans get over PTSD, you know, things like that, that heal the spirit, not just your economic situation, you know?
So this, Darian went ahead and went there because I was going to wait. The process of funding these organizations. So what I mean by that is, the grant side of it. We didn't put these groups through this hoop jumping way in order to receive funds. Like, when, and for me, that is a very Eurocentric way of donating money, giving grant money to organizations. There's all these loopholes and show and pony things that you have to do in order to get something to help people. And I appreciate the fact that the Racial Healing Justice Fund did the complete opposite. I've never seen a grant form like that before. It was absolutely simple and easy. And the folks that we talked to were super gracious, because every other grant that they tried to apply for or wanted to apply for took away from them actually doing the work, because they felt like they have to do so much, improve so much, and show so much that with the organizations that we were able to help fund, they didn't have to go through that.
Maybe if we could break down just a little bit more about your idea of a non-Eurocentric, decolonizing sort of approach to funding. For a lot of people who might listen to this, they may not have a very clear understanding. And maybe if you could just add a little bit more detail, I think that could help, or maybe some examples. So you've already mentioned and talked about, in some ways, removing lots of barriers to the application process. What does that look like? And, you know, if there are other thoughts that people have, or reflections people have shared with you, that will be helpful as well.
For me, like you said, the barriers, but then on some of the questions that was on the grant, on the application, it asked like your zip code and where you're the area that you want to help people in. Because sometimes, and this is not all the time, sometimes money is funded in an area that may not necessarily need it. And so we are intentional about reaching zip codes that absolutely need the help. So zip codes like 63106, 63108, 6311, 63135, 63137. So North City, parts of South City, the West End, North County. And I wish I knew Metro East zip codes, but I don't. But parts of Metro East, like the intentionality of making sure that dollars are going to the organizations and people that absolutely need it, and not going to big corporations who are not going to do as much as needed with the money that's given to them.
I think, yeah, the barrier is definitely number one. But I think one of the other parts of decolonizing our process was we didn't. So I also review applications for the Regional Arts Commission. And so they have a rubric, right? So you have a number system that I think is ranking 1 through 4, I believe, on each category, right? And if you get a certain number, then you could get passed on to then be deliberated on. But if you don't pass that threshold, then you probably don't even get deliberated about. So what tends to happen is organizations that have been in operation a long time, or organizations that have larger budgets, tend to get funded more often because of that. And we removed all of that. So you didn't have to be a certain size organization. You could be an individual and apply, as long as it seemed like it would help you heal yourself, you heal other people that you're working with, and so on. So removing that, those barriers, and then keeping in touch with people. We had Zoom calls and phone calls and text messages with people that were applying for funding throughout the process, whereas normally you're kind of left in the dark until the decision's made. So I really like that we kept in contact with people throughout the whole process as well.
Yeah, and we also offered assistance. Like, I don't know too many organizations that allow the board or the team to help the future grantee fill out the application.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned is certainly, you know, very different. You know, Rhonda and I, you know, as faculty members at universities, apply for lots of different types of grants. And certainly, you know, there's lots of, there's generally requirements, you know, to apply for grants and other types of eligibility criteria. And in many ways, you've talked about that, that was all removed. Because you're really interested in supporting individuals and or organizations that are committed to a particular cause or particular group and a particular focus, and you wanted to make sure that they were eligible in lots of different ways for this set of resources that they may not have been eligible for in other places.
Exactly.
One of the questions that I remember that's on the application is the organization lead Black, Brown, Indigenous, or POC?
So I think that was question number one.
Yeah, like that type of intentionality says a lot because you are specifically targeting a group of people that we deem, right, that need the help, or organization that is going to keep these group of people best interests at heart.
And just to be clear for the recording, you said that one of the first questions was asking if the applicant was a person of color or if the organization was Black or Brown or Indigenous led. Is that what I heard?
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah, so if the organization was led, like Black, Brown, Indigenous.
And were there similar questions about who they were serving? So you mentioned asking about zip codes. Were there other questions about, you know, descriptions or demographics of the populations or communities that they were hoping to serve or intending to serve?
Yeah, so one of the questions I remember was the service that they're providing, is this a direct need or is it indirectly? Like, would it instantly direct this group of people or will it over time indirectly serve them? Or am I saying that right, Darian? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Or is this youth-led? Is it health and food, I think, or health led, well-being? What was the other one? Youth, health and well-being.
Youth in the center, health and well-being, healing the healers, it was like healing the community. That wasn't the language.
And then there was another one that was basically kind of like offering for a salary increase for the individuals who work within the organization. So it seemed like it hit every bucket for healers because it is a taxing calling. If you're a healer, that's part of your calling, right? So we're making sure that the healers are being taken care of. And sometimes that can look like health and well-being, or sometimes that can look like increasing the salary pay because groceries have gotten expensive and gas has gone up. So it's making sure that we are healing people in totality in every sense that we can think of.
No, that's really amazing. We don't think about in the funding world, taking care of the people that are providing services, programs, interventions, all of those kinds of things, because they have needs as well, or have challenges, or maybe experiencing challenges.
Yeah.
And so that's just on the individual side, but you've also talked about, you know, supporting, for lack of a better way of explaining it, maybe thinking about the operational needs of an organization, which is a different part of capacity. And a lot of grants don't offer type of, you know, operational funds. And so that's really great to hear in lots of ways. And then also just supporting the work that they're doing. And so it's sort of an internal and an external way of thinking about it, kind of back to that metaphor and image that you gave. It really does sort of speak to sort of what's happening inside and outside. And that's really, and that, as I mentioned, that's sort of a fascinating model. And, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit more about the role of the CGB. You talked a little bit about some of the things in terms of how it relates to decolonizing philanthropy, removing lots of barriers to the funding process. So how does the CGB operate? And so what did you, when you came to this work, what is it that you expected to happen? And what happened?
Wow. That's a good question. I don't know what I tend to not come into things with expectations because that's how you get disappointed. So, I try not to have too many expectations. I did expect that we would, be working on anti-racist work. And I honestly was more pleased with the process than I expected. One of the things that happened in the early parts or early meetings was the leadership or the people that were helping facilitate us were like, bring your whole self. You know, if you want to use slang or you want to wear your J's or, you know, whatever, come like that. Don't, this is not a corporate space. You don't have to be afraid to say how you feel, like say it how it is, because we really want to take care of people. And part of that is being able to speak freely. So, and be present in all that you are. So I really appreciated that. And just how we took care of the process and the people that were applying. I just really appreciated how much care was taken at every moment in the throughout the process.
Yeah. I don't know what I expected, but what I didn't expect is the amount of time and attention and intention that the facilitators had on our own personal feelings. Like, we started each session with, how are you feeling today? And then by the end of the session, it's, how are you feeling? And sometimes, and some people may consider this unorthodox, but let's just say, for instance, if someone asks, you know, how are you feeling today? And a response was, well, you know, I experienced this today at work, or this happened to me going for a walk. And we actually took time out of that meeting and love on this individual who was experiencing a tough time, because if you're going to heal a community, you first have to be healed. And so that was something that I didn't expect at all, like to allow us to feel and then to say how we feel. I thought that was pretty cool. I had never been on the board before. This is my first time. And then two, from the stories that I've heard about being on a board, it was from a very corporate lens. So being in a space where it's not all about dollars and cents, but about community, was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah, and to kind of reiterate that, there was, I'll just say my dad died throughout the process. He got sick before I got on the board. And so when I came in, people kind of knew he got prostate cancer, and they knew, you know, he was in and out of the hospital, and I would say these things, and people would, you know, like, take care of me. I remember one meeting specifically, my dad went into the hospital. I got a text from my mom, and my dad went into the hospital, and I messaged Nicole, who was one of our facilitators. I was like, I'm probably not going to say this in the chat, but I got to go. My dad's in the hospital, this and that. She just said in the private chat, was like, go ahead, do what you need to do, take care of your family. And when I came back, people like Ashley and Shonda and some other people were just like, yo, how are you doing? You know, just checking in on you and things like that. And I don't experience that with a lot of friends. You know what I mean? So for board members to do that was a big deal.
I'm very sorry to hear about your dad. And it's, as you mentioned, it's interesting to work with people. And I don't know how many of them you knew before, but sort of to have that level of compassion, care, and concern, because you all are essentially doing work. And sometimes people just want to get back to business or expect you to compartmentalize things in a way. And in what you've described is that wasn't required of you to be a participant in this process. And as much as the principles that you talked about apply to who you were trying to support, those were also part of the process of operating the community governance board. And I think that's important for people to hear about and to know about and to figure out how that can become part of their work as well. So what were some things that you learned, you know, going through this process, learning how to work together, learning how to make decisions? What were some things that were new to you? We had an opportunity to chat with some other members on the Community Governance Board, and they were surprised at some of the things that they didn't know about either equity, some of the organizations in the space, some of the areas of focus of their work. Maybe there were some things like that that happened to you, or even just, you know, everything is new. I don't know.
I'll say this. What I learned or recognized is that the St. Louis region, and this includes Metro East, is a region of dope people. And when I say dope, I mean absolutely dope in every sense of the word. People who are really willing to get their hands and feet dirty for the common good of those who are oppressed. And it fills in every bucket. I was so shocked to see so many organizations filling a bucket for the youth, filling a bucket for housing, filling a bucket for post and prenatal care, filling a bucket for food, all these like city and I hate using the word urban, you know, urban gardens. Like, I was like, we have this many individuals out here doing the work, like hands down, dope. Like, I'm so, like, I've always been, like, so St. Louis, like, to the heart. But seeing that is, it just makes you proud because you see so much negativity about St. Louis. And so when I see these lists of things that people are actually doing and, like, really doing, not doing it for show, but, like, really doing it, man, that was awesome.
I mean, you stole my answer. We had 212 applications, if that tells you anything. And it was spread out across a bunch of all of our focuses as a board and more things that we weren't even thinking about. And it was just incredible to see how many. And then they would say, oh, but there's this other organization that didn't get to apply that's also doing this thing over here. So we maybe just got half to a third of everybody that's doing work in St. Louis. So it was incredible to see and learn how many different individuals and organizations are working on everything from media to childcare to education to healthcare to prison reform and transition and everything else in between. So that was the thing that I learned that was most not surprising, but like notable to me.
No, that's amazing. 200 applications is a lot. Even for, you know, larger funding entities. And that's a lot to process. So maybe talk a little bit about how you all process all of those applications, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, you all offered assistance, you know, consultations, you met with people, you know, during the application process. And I know you met with folks after they applied as well. So maybe if you could talk through, like, how do you apply these principles to making decisions?
Very difficult. talk about guilt, right? I mean, like, because you can't say yes to everybody. And the thing is, that's what made, it's a gift and a curse, because that lets you know that the work really is being done, that somebody is really out there, you know, putting their feet to the ground. And so that was really difficult, because I wanted to go through that list and be like, yes, 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 yes. And so, I mean, sometimes it's like flip of the coin, heads or tails, because it's like I can pick. Both of you are doing exactly, you know, similar things. You're checking off every box. You're hitting every, like, I's dotted, T's crossed. Like, how do I choose? And so that was really difficult. But again, it's a gift and a curse. I was like, man, if we can get, you know, everybody, if we could have said yes to everybody, man, that would have been like the cherry on top.
Yeah. My brain likes to think in numbers. So I'll just kind of go through that to kind of illustrate what it was like. And basically we had $10 million worth of asks, right? With all the applications, but we had $800,000 to give away. And so obviously not everybody got funded. That's like less than 10% of what was asked for, right? So, it was really meticulous. It was pretty drawn out. not that that was a bad thing, but it took way longer than expected because of how many applications were being reviewed and the level of scrutiny that we were giving to each application. So, you know, if we had questions about something, we'd call them or, you know, try to get them in for a meeting. And so it took us, what did you say? Like 8 months longer, Ashley, than we were supposed to.
Yeah, we were a little behind.
Yeah, we were a little behind. And the people that got funded obviously were happy, but we did have a process where we talked to the people that didn't get funded. And I definitely took on a lot of guilt from that because I wanted to have given them money, but we just couldn't. And so, but we also wanted to be able to give people a place to either gripe or give feedback about the process if they didn't, especially if they didn't get funded. Most of the people that got funded probably don't have much feedback.
Right. Which is another thing, Darian, which decolonized the grant process. How many organizations, and this is just me guessing, will talk to the folks who didn't get the money and like literally hear them out and say, hey, what could we have done different? What would you have liked us to do? Like any gripe, any question, we are here. And I was like, dang, we really gonna talk to these people? And so there were times I was in a hot seat. Like I was like, ooh.
Yeah, getting grilled. Like, why didn't I get the money? Like,
you had
a priority. We wanted to. We just couldn't. We didn't have the money. That's all. Yeah. That's all it came down to.
Literally.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of the priorities and principles that help you choose organization A over organization B? Because I think that can be helpful for those who, if the fund continues to think about, you know, ways to strengthen their organizations and their applications in the future.
I think what Ashley said earlier had a lot to do with the geographics. But then we had a second survey after the initial round for folks that we really thought would get funding. And then one of the questions was, how do you think this will impact the Black and Brown community in your area? And we were talking about 5 years down the road, how will you know if you have achieved the goal that you set out to do? And then it ended up giving scores to those answers just so we could kind of keep a consistent way of choosing. But the folks that had the stronger answers on how they knew they had achieved their goal and how it would benefit and positively impact the Black and Brown community were ones that I think we went with more. And if it was the less impact, less likely to get funding. But again, even some of the folks that might have like a smaller organization got funded because we saw where they were located.
Yep. He pretty much covered it. Because I mean, again, we're thinking about future and what the St. Louis region can look like. And so if there is a solid plan put in place that can be visualized and realistically accomplished, then, I mean, of course you're going to go with this organization. And not saying that the other one didn't deserve it or, you know, were less than of, it's just that the way that picture was painted.
So some of it is about the storytelling of the organization themselves, the work that they're doing and the potential impact of that. And some people are a little bit more polished and experienced with doing that and others are not, or others you may imagine are at a place where they're still trying to figure some of that out or they're learning from their own work and trying to figure out how to articulate that. And I think that's sort of a really important sort of just, you know, a few things to reflect on for those who may listen to this and may think about, you know, what are ways that they can enhance themselves, enhance their organizations to be a little bit more competitive, not only for this fund, but for other funds. Are there any other sort of pieces of advice to potential grantees that you'd like to give?
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
because I think it's not been mentioned yet, that even the application, the actual application itself was not traditional, right? You didn't have to write everything down on paper, and that may have contributed to your ability to storytell. So if you can kind of give your perspectives on you know, an organization or an individual's ability to make a video or have all these different ways to tell their story. How do you think that came across and worked as a way to really give healers money to continue to heal their community by letting them use different ways to tell their story about how they're going to do their healing?
Ashley?
So that was one of the barriers that was broken down, right? Because you have some people who are not in a traditional sense can fill out a traditional grant form because they can be very time consuming and intimidating. And so the goal of the Racial Healing Justice Fund was to take all of that stress and mess away so that we can get the funds in the hands of the organizations that needed it. And so storytelling is one of those components that we thought, you know, would be a good idea. If you want to upload a video or, you know, record how you're going to do this, that was one of the ways that we felt we could, one, reach more people, and two, give more people a chance to apply for the grant.
And I think that was something that was intentional from the beginning. We didn't necessarily, because I believe me and Ashley came on the board.
Right, let me clarify. Yeah, that wasn't our idea. That was the group before us.
Mm-hmm. But the point was, how many ways can we give or make available to people to tell their story so that if you're not good at writing, then you can make a video. And if you don't have the ability to make a video, we can do a quick interview call or, there were just multiple ways that you could submit. You could just submit, you know, press that you've been in and things like that, so that whatever way you could figure out to tell the story of your organization, there that was available.
Ron, I'm glad you asked that question because you've said it, but I want to make sure that it's clear for people. You've also sort of radically shifted and thought about a decolonization process of access. One of the, you know, huge barrier or huge burden to people, as you've already mentioned and talked about, is thinking about how do I synthesize whatever it is I need to and fit it into an application. And we know from, you know, our own experiences and working with others and sometimes even from research that the idea of access, going to an office, filling out paperwork, or helping someone else fill out paperwork, whatever it may be, is onerous in many ways. And you've really talked about the idea of how do you sort of help make that as easy as possible so people can tell their story. And I forgot about that, and I'm glad Rhonda brought it up. And I think it's a really amazing thing to sort of consider and really needs to be thought about in this described in different ways about how that can be a model for other organizations and maybe even for, you know, social services as well. Go ahead, Rhonda.
Because there's that, what do you call it? You know, the poverty tax, right?
Yeah.
The less you have, the more systems you have to negotiate, right? You've got to negotiate rental assistance and WIC and SNAP and all of these other things. And so, in order to even survive, the less you have and the harder you have to work to survive, the more systems you have to negotiate. So by like breaking that down, right, that it's just like in kind of keeping with like going against the system that can be oppressive, right? Like you're trying to break down all of those. Like, we're not going to give you more things. We already know that you are either yourself as an organization or trying to heal folks that have to negotiate multiple systems for their survival. We're not going to give you another one to negotiate.
That's exactly it. I think even in my own application for other grants, I know that I've never seen a process this open before. But I think it allowed us to see how much work actually is going on in St. Louis from the number of people that said, I've never applied for a grant before. We only applied for this because, number one, it was for Black and Brown people, but also your application was really easy. So, and we got that feedback from a number of applicants. So I know it made a difference in just this class, but I hope that it will influence other bodies that do funding, to see that, you know, sometimes you're missing people that are doing good work simply because you have some barriers up.
Yep.
So I'm curious, and I'm going to pick up on your reflection of your meetings. You know, you all have had different kinds of experiences, whether it's, you know, helping people get resources, applying for grants, being involved in different organizations. And you both mentioned that you came in on the last cycle of this iteration of the Racial Healing and Justice Fund. And I imagine you heard some things before you came on and you joined, and then you became part of the process. And so I'm curious, how did you feel being, you know, again, in the seat? You mentioned it was very difficult, but actually seeing some of these principles and these values taking shape, taking form throughout this work.
So it made me feel that St. Louis as a whole, St. Louis region, is not all talk and no show. So, like, not only are we talking about the work that we're doing, not only are we talking about the area that we hope can come into fruition one day, but there is actually work behind these words. And it's not just a few people or a person here or a person there. That is just a large group of people doing the work and continuing to do it. So we are coming up almost on 10 years of, you know, the killing of Michael Brown Jr. And so the fact that the momentum, you know, in some ways, some people may say it has, you know, died down a little bit. But what showed me that it hasn't is the amount of people that applied, and then hearing more stories of, I didn't even know that existed, but this is what I'm doing. And so the momentum is still going. St. Louis is still striving to be a more racially equitable society. There are people out there, really grassroots-led organizations that are really, really trying to do the work.
Yeah, I mean, just to talk about how I felt, I a lot of times was coming into the meetings very tired. Most of us are all doing many other things outside of the board meetings. But when I would come in and we would do the work together, I left the meetings more energized than when I came a lot of times. Just to see people, like Ashley said, people in space or on Zoom doing the work, clearly thinking through these decisions and carefully making these choices, it made me feel like Ashley said, 10 years after Michael Brown was killed, that, okay, maybe we are doing something to respond to that. Whether or not much has changed in policing, at least this organization is trying to do something to right those wrongs, right? So I felt great about it every time I went to a meeting. There was not a meeting where I felt like, oh, that could have been an email, right?
Yeah. It makes you feel good. Like, man, I'm part of the solution, mm-hmm. right? Even if I'm just sitting on the board, I am part of the solution. I am part of the story. I am part of the history that want to make the St. Louis region better. And who wouldn't feel good about being in that position? We're part of history. We really are.
No, you absolutely are. And, you know, these are the stories that I feel are hidden. And you may agree to some extent that we don't hear enough about what's working well in the St. Louis metro area. I mean, we already know there are incredible problems, incredible challenges, a very long history. But you both have really mentioned that there's a lot of great work happening. What What do you think is needed to support these organizations and to continue to tell or figure out ways to tell the stories of the work of these organizations that's all this work that's happening in the region?
I don't know if I can say this.
Sorry.
So besides funding, man, you put us on the spot with that one. Besides funding, I think another strong support would be our elected officials. Mm. Another support would be our media. Because, see, the media tells the story. The media is the one, in so many ways, controls that narrative. And so we got to get our media behind telling these stories of what these organizations are doing and showing the data on how it is impacting St. Louis in a positive way. I think that's really important. Numbers talk, and they can paint that picture for you. So, yeah, I would say besides funding and money, our elected officials, and media. We got to get the media on the right track.
Can I ask you a question? Oh, yeah, go ahead, Darren. Go ahead.
Those are the best answers. Go ahead. No, go ahead, Kim. I was just saying, well, you had the best answers.
Actually. What's the messaging that's needed? So, like, every audience, you know, thinks about different things, or they respond or, you know, resonate with certain things. Let's just take elected officials as an example. What is it that you think they need to hear about the work of the fund, the work of the organizations that the fund has supported, to rethink what they are doing in the policy making space?
So what do they need to hear? I think they need to hear real life testimonies. So those constituents that voted them in, sit down and have a conversation with them and explain to them how this small organization help them through this particular life situation. Or this urban farm, this city-grown farm helped put food on the table for me and my kids for a week because the grocery store down the street just closed. You know, I think it's important for our politicians to really be engaged. And I'm not talking about sending out some emails and asking for survey responses and all of that, which I think is fine. I'm not against emails, but I'm asking for more one-on-one and, like, for real, genuine, intentional one-on-one. Go walk up and down the street that you are serving. Walk in that neighborhood that you are serving. And it's time to get from behind that desk. And I probably said too much, so I'm going to stop.
I was going to say, how honest can we be about this answer?
You know, be as honest as you don't want to get anybody in trouble. I'll just say that.
I'll just say that they need to hear how it benefits them and their constituents, similar to what Ashley said. But I definitely think about most of the older people, at least, live in their ward. And so if we're talking about different locations from different zip codes and things like that, if we can tell the story of what's happening in that zip code through the organizations that are doing the work in that area and show how it would benefit that older person, that state rep, you know, that senator, and help them get reelected. I think that's honestly what they need to hear. But if there's a way for their areas to benefit, I think hopefully that would be enough. But obviously they want to stay in office. So that's another piece of it.
Yeah. Maybe one of the things that could happen is some more localized storytelling, maybe with partnering with neighborhood associations or some other sort of neighborhood focused groups or meetings that are already sort of on the books, on the schedule, that some of the organizations can go and talk about their work and talk about how they utilize some of the funds to support those neighborhoods or those areas. Does that sound like something that's possible, feasible?
I think that's doable.
I think that's doable. Not to sound too old school, but I remember growing up, we had like block parties and a block captain. Hey. And that block captain was like our liaison to our alder person. So maybe if we just kind of go back to something like that, you know, having someone to be that bridge, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Okay. Well, I appreciate all the time that you have shared with us today. Last question, any other thoughts, suggestions for sustainability, next steps of the racial healing and justice fund?
If anyone from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is listening, please make some funds available again for another round of this. If we could sustain this type of funding, to me, that would eventually heal the core. Eventually. Obviously, we're just kind of putting a drop in the bucket now. Like I said, it's just 800,000 this year. And I think it was like 3 million over the last 3 years. But if we could keep it going, that's what we need. Whoever can fund this, it doesn't have to be Robert Wood Johnson either. We would gladly reboot this project.
Just to piggyback off of what Darian said, if there is anything that we need to do or say to convince funders, all funders, to add to this bucket, please let us know. Do we need to write some type of form, create some type of video? Like, what do we need to do to convince those with money that this is worth it? This is an investment, that there will be a return on your investment.
Can I ask, I know I said that was the last question, but is there a part of this that could be, you know, we're in a time now where lots of things get crowdsourced, or, you know, whether it's GoFundMe or something else. Is there a space for that for the fund to continue?
I'm not above it. I am not above crowdfunding. I am not above fundraising. I'm not above any of that, simply because we know that this is a benefit, that these funds are not just going towards anyone or anybody or any organization, that this is a real benefit for the St. Louis region. If we are operating in a sense where people are thriving, it is better for us economically. It is better for us for our mental health. Like, studies have shown that when a group of people are thriving, that area is doing better in every bucket that you can think of. So it's an investment. It's definitely an investment. Invest in people.
Darian, anything else you want to add?
I couldn't have said it better myself. Ashley, yeah, you got it. That's it.
All right. Well, again, thank you both for your time, for sharing your thoughts and reflections on being on the Community Governance Board and being a part of this amazing initiative called the Racial Healing and Justice Fund. We will continue the conversation with some other Community Governance Board members and also some of the administrative leaders of the fund and of Ford through Ferguson as well.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing and being open and honest. I appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to the Critical Futures podcast. If you're feeling inspired and looking for more resources, please check out www.ihje.org/podcast for show notes and links to resources and to subscribe. Thanks for tuning in.